Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Don? You know what? I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3 here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best of new indie, electro, EDM and punk and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7pm here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
N-E-X-T.
Oh, good morning. Welcome to the Live Sounds Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org. You can listen online there anywhere in the world if you fancy. You can also go there and pick up the podcast, download them and listen at your leisure. Even save them if you want to. It is a bank holiday weekend, August bank holiday weekend. Can you believe Saturday the 24th of August 2024, just in case you are listening on catch up. Got Julian Paul here live as we always are. Every Saturday morning, 11 till 12, talking about science in all its different forms. And if you're a regular listener, you'll notice we've changed the intro as well. And there's going to be some other changes coming up today. And even PG doesn't know about them. It's exciting stuff. This week, we've got a very special guest speaker. It's Denise Pullen, and she's going to be talking about her food journey, moving from America to the UK. Mm. Exciting. Next week, all being well, and indeed, whenever there are five Saturdays in the month, it's Phil Muffett from the Mexburg and Swinton Astronomical Society doing All Being Well in Astro Clinic. Who knows what that will be about? Later in the show, we're going to be talking to our PG. Before that, we've got a few things to talk about. Paul is going to talk about juice.
Not as in apple juice, no. But as in a spacecraft. It may be on its way to explore the moons of Jupiter, but this week, the European Space Agency's juice spacecraft will whiz 430 miles above our own moon. It will then pass 4,300 miles above the Earth, from where it was launched in April 2023 in the first ever double gravity assist on its way to the gas giant Jupiter. The manoeuvre is a crucial step on its circuitous 8-year journey as it saves fuel by exploiting the gravitational pull of Earth. It will put the craft in the correct position to pass Venus next year, then the Earth twice more in 2026 and 2029. With each of these catapults, it steals a bit of momentum from the planets, giving it the energy to reach Jupiter. The space agency hopes that when JUICE begins the scientific phase of its mission in 2031, it will give us a better understanding of Jupiter's many moons and three particular. Here we go.
Ganymede, Europa and Callisto.
Beneath their icy crust, scientists believe there are liquid water oceans. Potentially, they could be habitable.
All interesting stuff. This next one's a very interesting one and a very timely one, I think. Watch out for fake QR parking codes. So drivers have been advised to pay for parking using cash, good luck with that then, card or official apps amid arising scams involving fake QR codes in car parks. Criminals put up stickers or posters showing fake codes as they try to catch out motorists who are in a rush. When drivers scan the codes, they are directed to a fake website and ask for their bank account details to pay for their parking. Criminals then use the details to withdraw money. The breakdown firm RAC urge drivers to be very vigilant and stick with official means of payment. Many of the fake codes have been appearing at council car parks, where many parking machines are being replaced by app payments that require a smartphone. Drivers who fall for the scam can not only have money stolen but also get a parking ticket because they haven't actually paid for parking. The maximum fine you can get from a council is £130 in London or £70 outside of London. The maximum private car park is £100. Now, Simon Williams from the RAC said the safest course of action when paying for parking at a council-owned car park is to avoid QR codes altogether. Most of councils don't even operate a QR code payment system. So if you're in any doubt, steer well clear and only pay with a cash card or via an official app downloaded from your smartphone's app store. He also said drivers should also follow this advice when using electric vehicle charging points and private car parks. So that's one to watch out for. Next one. Oh, I saw this. I thought, wow. Professor, it's called The Life Scientific. It's BBC Radio 4. It was actually, first episode was aired Tuesday, which was earlier this week, 20th of August at 9 o'clock. Bill Gates on vaccines, conspiracy theories, and the pleasures of pickleball. So it's Professor Jim Al-Khalil's compulsive series returns with a big hitting first guest, Bill Gates, a super geek who made good on his promise to put a computer in every home and in every office. So Al-Khalil trails Gates as the world's most famous college dropout, richest man in the world, global philanthropist, even tech supervillain, which is quite the introduction. So Bill Gates left the day-to-day running of Microsoft in 2008 to focus on his Gates Foundation, one of the world's largest charities, where Bill and his billions have taken on issues around health, inequality, education and climate change in some of the world's poorest countries. And this article says, but he is first and foremost a scientist, and that forms the bulk of this fascinating conversation between the two men. Bill Gates invests more money in science each year than most countries, driven by the deaths of millions in poor countries from preventable diseases such as malaria and pneumonia. Making cheap vaccines and developing new ones became the foundation's focus, leading Bill Gates to be defied by many but vilified by anti-vaxxers. So Al-Khalil quizzes Bill Gates on conspiracy theories, artificial intelligence, but also uncovers his humble taste. Now get this, because it's relevant to later on in the show, cheeseburgers and a bingeable spy series and a game of pickleball. So that series is The Life Scientific. It's BBC Radio 4. You can get it on iPlayer. Go and check it out, because it's not just Bill Gates he interviews. He's going to interview a whole load of other people. Fantastic stuff.
The science of extraordinary things.
Amazing. Any excuse for a bit of Bill Nelson? That was from 2018, The Science of Extraordinary Things, because we're talking about the new radio programme on Radio 4, The Life Scientific. Just tuned in. This is, of course, the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. Next up, it's this week's environment update. Paul, come on, you're kicking off this, aren't you?
Plastic in negotiations towards an international treaty to limit plastic pollution. The US has signalled for the first time that it would be open to putting limits on plastic production. Previously, it had rejected production limits in favour of a greater focus on increasing plastic recycling.
Next up, sea temperature. A record was broken the other week, with the temperature at the surface of the Mediterranean Sea logged at a daily median of 28.9 Celsius. And that's according to the Instituto de Ciencias, I'm sure I haven't said that right, Del Mar in Spain. It surpassed the previous record of 28.7 Celsius set in July last year.
Droughts are now a bigger threat to British nature reserves than pollution. According to a new report by the Wildlife Trust, 90% of ecologists at the organisation, which owns 2,600 nature reserves across the country, said that drought was already having a negative impact.
And talking about drought, wildfires. Smoke from wildfires across the Atlantic brought spectacular, vivid colours to sunsets and sunrises across the UK last weekend. Fires have blazed across North America this summer, and smoke particles have been carried by the jet stream to the skies above the British Isles. Because the smoke was high up, there was no risk to people's health, and it only lasted a few days because more unsettled weather began to disperse the smoke in the upper atmosphere. Now then, next up is a story about the Scottish Isles may solve the mystery of Snowball Earth.
Yes, the Garvillac Islands off the west coast of Scotland are the best record of Earth entering its biggest ever ice age around 720 million years ago, researchers have discovered. The big freeze, which covered nearly all the globe in two phases for 80 million years, is known as Snowball Earth, after which the first animal life emerged. Clues hidden in rocks about the freeze have been wiped out everywhere except in the Garvillacs. Researchers hope the islands will tell us why Earth went into such an extreme icy state for so long and why that process was necessary for complex life to emerge. The Earth became almost completely covered in ice during the longest and most severe ice age in the planet's history. Layers of rock can be thought of as pages of a history book, with each layer containing details of the Earth's condition in the distant past. But the critical period leading up to Snowball Earth was thought to be missing because the rock layers were eroded by the big freeze. Now a study by researchers at University College London has revealed that the Garvillacs somehow escaped unscathed. It may be the only place on Earth to have a detailed record of how the Earth entered one of the most catastrophic periods in its history, as well as what happened when the first animal life emerged when the snowball thawed hundreds of millions of years ago.
So back then, Scotland was in a completely different place, can you believe? Because the continents have moved over time. It was south of the Earth's equator and had a tropical climate until it and the rest of the planet became engulfed in ice. The islands in the Inner Hebrides of Scotland are uninhabited, apart from a team of scientists working out of the main island's solitary building, although there are also ruins of a 6th century Celtic monastery there. The breakthrough was made by Professor Shields' PhD student Elias Rugan, whose results have been published in the Journal of the Geological Society of London. Now, Elias is the first to date the rock layers and identify them as from the critical period that is missing from all other rock formations in all other parts of the world. So it's a massive, massive discovery. His discovery puts the Garvillacs in line for one of the biggest accolades in science, the Golden Spike, hammered in at locations identified as the best record of planet-changing geological moments. This breakthrough does win the Golden Spike, which isn't made of gold, otherwise people would steal it. It's made of something else. Then the prize would raise the scientific profile of the location, attract further research funding. All good stuff.
You never take advice.
Cold as Ice, Foreigner. We played that because the Scottish Isles may solve the mystery of Snowball Earth. How exciting, eh? Who'd have believed it used to be south of the equator? Frightening stuff. Anyway, of course, you're listening to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM, talking about science in all its different forms. We should have our PG on the line. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning.
We thought you might like that, because your normal topic on this show is bits and pieces.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, eh? Eh? All good stuff, eh? So what's caught your eye this week then, Paul?
Well, a little bit. I mean, obviously, I mean, looking at the news of the sad loss of the luxury yacht off Italy, but looking at the oceans in general, but I thought I'd start off just on the local front with a bit of news from Sheffield University. And they've just published a new report yesterday, and it's calling for a digital vaccination for all children. And it's to tackle the tsunami of fake news and disinformation and close the digital divide.
Wow.
Basically, they're saying that a lot of children just aren't armed for the current digital world, and being able to recognise what's fake news and what's correct. So it involves the University of Sheffield and partners, and highlights the digital divide that hinders economic growth. So they reckon it costs us $65 million a year, I think, at the moment, but I think that's an underestimate. As millions of children are left behind with a lack of access to digital technology, they found 40% of children, that's somewhere like 6 million children, don't have access to either a home broadband or a laptop or desktop computer. And, correct myself, it's actually, they estimate the cost is $65
billion
each
year.
Wow. Yeah. So it calls for adopting a minimum digital living standard framework to ensure every household has a digital infrastructure necessary for the future job landscape. And it's evidence of a plan for upskilling our children and young people for digital futures. And Professor Jennifer Rousel from the University School of Education says the age AI, data literacies, and platformization of education is upon us, and children and young people must be able to navigate the digital lives critically and safely. So it gives a detailed picture of the digital inequalities in the UK and shows how by 2030 many workers will be considered underskilled in basic capabilities. So the point we've sort of touched on before, I think, that they seek to establish this minimum digital living standards framework, enhance inclusivity in schools through continuing professional development for the educators, because obviously the teachers have got to try and keep up with technology if they're going to try and bring the kids along with it as well. They want to create a national digital creativity skills commons, and one of those things that the executive chair for the Centre of Young Lives, Anne Longfield, said, children are growing up digital, but we're not giving them the technology and the skills they need to make the most of opportunities it brings or protection they need to navigate online safely. So, important things, I think, and again, interesting bit of work from Sheffield University.
I find it very interesting, Paul, because the other side of that is a big push to get the government to do something about kids being addicted to the phones and getting off the phones because they're unable to interact with people. They don't know what's true, what they read.
Well, I think there's also a question about the way that the powers that be are actually delivering stuff on mobile phones. So we've heard about clickbait. You know, it's ridiculous things or weird supposed happenings that children can click on because it's actually a money generator for someone. And the problem is that to be sort of remarkable or different, they put out all sorts of disinformation. And children are sort of force-fed this because the algorithms that pick stuff for them are actually sort of concentrating the feeds down the line. So if you happen to click on something and create one of those links, all of a sudden you can have a stream of information from something weird and wonderful that you weren't expecting. So I think this is great to try and educate people. And I think, you know, we saw a minor push, I think, from the banks to try and educate old folks like me into banking online and things. It can't be a vested interest at all. But, I think they're really sort of a drop in the ocean when it comes to what the kids have got to face up to, because artificial intelligence is really sort of driving a change that's coming through now. And it makes identifying those fake items harder.
Really difficult. And AI is not stopping, is it? It's here and it's on its way and nothing's going to stop it. And it's how, you know, we control how it's used. And
yep.
Very interesting times, Paul. You know, I don't want to be growing up in these times as a young child.
No, well, I think, yeah, we've got to cope with it. And hopefully the powers that be, like Sheffield University, are starting to look at a track to bring us up to scratch.
It's an issue of modern times, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I think it's, things do change. And unfortunately, the pace of change seems to be increasing exponentially. So you hardly get a chance to assimilate one technology before there's another and another and another coming through. And when your basic sort of trawl for information is online, and, we've seen the decline of book libraries and libraries trying to twist and themselves into something for the future. What source have you got? And if you look at the sort of newspaper world, there's a change going through there. So it's a matter of what you can trust. And unfortunately, a lot of the modern world is still not as policed as a lot of the other technologies were.
No.
But anyway, oceans is what I had on my mind. And sort of looking at what's been happening after that was, I actually caught the end of a documentary piece, which was about monitoring great white sharks in Australia. And a team had managed to tag a 3.5 meter long great white, and they were tracking it off the coast of Australia. And on the track, once they got a sensor mounted on the shark, it went off and disappeared on something like a 1,000 kilometer round trip around the coast and came back.
Wow.
While they were trying to monitor it on a boat, this shark attacked the boat. So, and they said it was a really sort of dedicated attack rather than just a brief encounter. They really felt that the shark was trying to tip them out the boat into the water. They started thinking that they might not be monitoring, but might be coming foodstuff.
Oh, gosh.
So eventually the shark sort of gave up on this attack. And they continued the tracking, and so it disappeared off, and it down to something like 100 meter depth plus further out. And they were sort of monitoring the movement of the shark, but also things like its body temperature. And all of a sudden, from about 100 metres, it kind of went in a steep dive down to something like 400 metres. And they were surprised at the movement. But its body temperature was dropping as it went down. But then all of a sudden, its body temperature seemed to shoot up to 26, 27 degrees. And they were perplexed by that. And it stayed around at depth for a short time and then slowly started to come back up to something like the original depth. And all of a sudden, they lost the signal. So their conjecture was that something like a monster of the deep must have...
Not the Loch Ness monster of the deep, I hope. Because that's got its 90th, is it 90th anniversary or something?
Yeah, well, this one they're saying the temperature that they were monitoring was the actual sort of temperature that you'd expect to find in the stomach of a creature like the great white. But then they said, well, what kind of monster can swallow 3.5 metres of...
yeah. Oh, my word.
Shark. But they didn't know. And wow. It disappeared. So it kind of then, while that was on my mind, I saw another piece of research, which I think is National Geographic have got Ocean Explorers. And it's a boat that goes out monitoring the oceans. And they say that 70% of the Earth's surface is covered by ocean and more than 80% of that realm's completely unknown. So
wow.
The crew aboard this vessel, it's a documentary series by James Cameron, the filmmaker. And it's on the National Geographic channel. So if people want to track it down on National Geographic, it's aboard the Ocean Explorer. And it's a ship that's fitted out with a helicopter, deep sea submersible, remote operated vehicles, and even holographic virtual reality lab that helps them visualize what's happening in the deep sea. And it takes viewers around the world in tropical waters in the Caribbean, Atlantic Ocean, and right up to the Arctic Ocean. And in the second episode, they go to a spot just off the Azores Islands where sperm whales dive. So they can plunge down to about a mile deep for up to an hour at a time. And so this documentary explains how it manages that. And it says sperm whales dive so deep that it's never been filmed before. So they were really pleased when they managed to build a camera tag that would withstand that pressure of the dive.
Yeah,
and
wow.
Attach it. So once it's ready, they put it onto a sperm whale. And said that because whales were hunted up until as recently as 1987, some of these whales can reach up to 70 years old. So they're very wary of ships and were very hesitant around this explorer vessel. So two of the crew members went off and attached it. So they got in an inflatable motorboat and drove up to this... wonderful sperm whale. And then they sent somebody up in a helicopter to see what was happening. And they actually then eventually got the whale when it came back to the surface after its dive and managed to get the attached camera. And that footage showed that for about 275 metres in the depth of this dive, a sperm whale's the tail stops moving almost entirely, because from then on, it relies on gravity taking it down.
Wow.
And it goes to nearly 450 metres, 455 metres below the surface. And because it's not doing the work, it's using gravity, that saves oxygen and energy while it descends to there. When it gets to that kind of depth, it does a click echo sounding, looking for its prey, food. And they saw this sperm whale come to the surface, and then a second sperm whale appeared. So they were very happy, and it's the first time you've seen that. But coincidentally, with the missing great white, the kind of depth that it disappeared at, and the depth it got down to, and the possibility, I mean, the great thing about sperm whales is they were always eating giant squid, which are very deep ocean dwellers. So my 10-penneth conjecture is, what if a sperm whale got hold of the great white and took it down?
Squid.
it could. Well, it's, you know, it doesn't just eat squid; it eats other things as well. But just wondering what kind of a monster could get down that deep. Hmm. Well, there's a candidate for you.
Oh, so. Brilliant! Oh, fascinating stuff as always, Paul. Enjoy the rest of your bank holiday, even though it's a bit cloudy. Boo.
Yes. Well, I won't do anything fishy, so.
Brilliant. All right, we'll speak to you Monday, Glory's Rock Show. 1 till 3. Cheers. All being well. Bye bye, Paul. Bye.
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 Bye. Bye, guys. Bye.
Led Zeppelin live there, the ocean, because our PG was talking about the oceans and all sorts of sperm whales and things like that. But if you've just tuned in, you're of course listening to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org, talking about science in all its different forms. Now, we've got a very special guest speaker today. It's Denise Pullen. She's a friend of Chris Dale's. She's going to be talking about a food journey moving from the US to the UK. Okay, but if you're tuning regularly, of course you'll know that we've been doing a lot about diet and food and the impact of that diet on health. And according to the World Health Organization, in 2030, the UK will become the fattest country in Europe. By 2040, 4 in 10 of the population will be obese. Medical experts now believe that the impacts of ultra-processed food is so bad it now needs the most significant health intervention since tobacco was linked to cancer. So as I said, over the last year, Chris Dale has been doing regular updates about the impact of hyper-palatable food, ultra-processed food as it's also known, and ready meals, and the impact that has on our health. The impact of those type of foods and the North American diet in particular is impacting on the health of other countries too, like India. Now, India is a very interesting one. With the opening up of the market, the fast food industry was very quick to establish itself. And as a result, India is now set to have the highest rates of diabetes, hypertension, which is blood pressure, and heart disease and cancer in the world by 2050. So, as I said, we've got a very special guest. Denise moved from the United States of America to Sheffield. And she's going to be on the line very shortly to tell us about a food journey. So,
you taste it.
Good morning, Denise.
Hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm all right, thanks. How are you doing?
Very well. Loving your accent. Fantastic. I thought you might have lost your accent completely.
If you ask people here, no, but in the US, they think I put one on.
Yeah, you sound a bit different. Firstly, thank you so much, Denise, for joining us. Particularly,
thanks for having me.
It's bank holiday weekend as well. And I was going to say, how do you come to live in sunny Sheffield? But it's not sunny today, I'm afraid. It's cloudy.
No.
So tell us a bit about yourself and how you ended up here.
Thanks, Julie, for having me. And, of course, thanks to my friend Chris Dale for suggesting I share my food journey experience, which he and his family have been a really big part of. As for a little bit about me, my parents were in the U.S. Air Force, so we moved around a bit when I was little and settled in Florida, where I lived until about 2000. Then I moved to Buffalo, New York, famous for its snow and chicken wings.
Oh,
I was there for a few years, then off to Chicago, Illinois.
Wow.
I'd say my diet there was typically American, deli sandwiches, barbecuing or grilling out, as we say, burgers, pizza, but not every day, of course. However, I did grow up eating New Mexican and American Italian food at home because of my parents' heritage. I hadn't really been exposed to other international food like curries, Middle Eastern, or even dim sum, mainly because I was a fussy eater.
Oh, yeah.
But moving out of Florida, it started to open my eyes to how food is different across other parts of the U.S. And then, of course, moving to the U.K. continued that education. So I moved here in about 2007, working for a global company, and the assignment kept getting extended. So 5 years on, I decided to stay living in sunny Sheffield, not because of the food.
No.
But the lifestyle surrounding the food did make a big difference to my decision staying in the UK. And of course, my personal circumstances, the friends I've made, the people here. I just really like how I feel living in Sheffield in the UK.
Yeah, it's quite a move, though.
Yeah.
I mean, America's a massive, massive country. So
it is huge, and there's all different types of food. But for some reason, I go from Florida to
here.
Buffalo, and then over here with the snow.
And you're still here. Fantastic.
Yeah.
And I'm sure Chris and Sue had something to do with that. I'm waiting. You want to stay. When you did move to Sheffield, clearly it's a big change in culture coming from America. So how did you find it?
Yeah, it was certainly an adventure and learning a new language.
Cause yeah.
I speak American, not English, as I've learned over the years. So the driving and the weather had its moments, and they still do. But my dog at the time, Chili, she and I were warmly welcomed to Sheffield. I had a fantastic group of colleagues and neighbors who looked after me. They taught me what to say and, more importantly, what not to say. they've all become very close friends. So I was on my own then, and the Dales and my other neighbours often fed me.
Look at you.
To new foods, yeah, and many seafood dishes, because surprisingly, growing up in Florida, I didn't eat a lot of fish, which, looking back, is a shame, really. So I didn't want to be rude while they were feeding me, so I had to learn quickly to try new things. And so that's how I got settled into Sheffield.
Amazing.
Food.
Yeah, yeah, I have to credit Chris and Sue with getting us to eat fish as well, because I'm ashamed to say, until really they started cooking for us, we weren't really that interested, which
yeah,
is bad.
Same here. Yeah.
It's bad, isn't it? So,
it's amazing.
Yeah, when you came to the UK, what were you actually expecting to eat then? Was it, you know, did you think it would be the same or?
Well, I did expect that, the stereotypical traditional UK food, fish and chips, bangers and mash, pie and peas. But I wasn't prepared for the variety of curries, amazing cheeses, accessibility to the multicultural food, because of being so close to the continent, I guess, and from what I understand about UK's history of immigration, similar to the US, it's brought some fantastic and delicious cuisines.
Yeah.
So since I moved, the world has changed, and I always love to hear fellow expats' hacks and experiences. But 17 years ago, I couldn't find my typical US go-to food, like what I call deli cold cuts for sandwiches, dill pickles. I miss my dill pickles. sauces, spices. So as I said, I was forced to try new things, and some went down, sorry, pun intended. Well, some didn't go down so well, but a few experiences started to change my eating habits, like visiting local bakers, butchers, farm shops, and having to shop smaller and more frequently because of the size of my tiny little fridge, and realizing the food I was choosing didn't have as many preservatives.
Oh, interesting.
And this was really different to how I shopped in the US, because we were shopping in a big food store weekly, maybe even fortnightly, to do a large shop and fill my big fridge, big pantry with food that usually lasted a long time.
Oh, this is going to be interesting, this preservatives business. So yeah. What foods do you eat now, and how would you say your diet is different to what you used to eat? Because I'm guessing now you're a bit more aware of the preservatives in things.
Yeah, so 17 years on, I have matured and expanded my palate. I am less picky as I eat and try different types of food, but I am more particular about what I choose. So my partner, Richard, and I tend to eat whole food-based meals, fermented foods, a lot more beans, fruit and veg, and less meat than we used to. We do subscribe to a weekly veg box, which introduced us to eating more seasonally and trying new veggies, things that we wouldn't really pick up when we go to the food store. So I do look at the ingredients as well, more than I used to. Although previously I rarely ate ready-made meals because I was picky, I would still prepare meals with prepackaged sauces and spices and seasoning packs. But I try to avoid those now and experiment with cooking from scratch when I have the time or the motivation. But I am human. I'm not perfect. I do enjoy my food. So on occasion, there are still times I will indulge or take some shortcuts, but it's a lot less than before.
So what do you think triggered that big change? Was it Richard? Or was it just a combination of things?
I think it's education, just really understanding the science behind food, and probably shopping more locally as well.
Yeah, because, I mean, at the minute, you're in the press, whole foods, and you mentioned beans, which is pulses, that's a big deal at the minute because a lot of people aren't eating those sorts of things. So, well, you know, when you go back to the States then, what do you think, and what do you think about how your palate's changed?
Yeah, so I always ask my friends what they want to eat first when they go back to their roots, what's on their list, because when I go back, I will indulge in my nostalgic favorites based on the city I'm in. And I know it's not always great for my waistline or my health, but it is just once in a while. My palate has changed, so I don't need as much salt or seasoning as I used to. And I can find that can be heavy in the US because I prefer the taste of the food itself rather than the added seasoning. But of course, the local food I'm here, I'm used to here in the UK probably has more flavor in my opinion. But I also understand now more about how the US food industry works. So I find the food supply to those big US food stores that has less flavor and needs more or different seasoning and usually has lots of preservatives. So when I do go and eat in the US, I try to introduce recipes or hacks that I have here in the UK. I do look at those ingredients on the labels in the US. And in fact, if I could share a surprising story recently, my mom came here in the UK to visit me earlier in the year and fell in love with a scrumptious, wait for it, blood orange chocolate creamsicle cocktail.
Wow.
Created by a local craft gin company, Loxley Distilling.
Oh, yes.
If you've heard of it.
Yes.
I mean, the cocktail is amazing. Can't get enough of it. But she wanted to recreate that cocktail back home in the US for her friends. Unfortunately, when she added the cream, it didn't behave and float on top the same way it did here in the UK. So I said, well, when I visit you, we'll try it again. But I was surprised to find in her US food store, it didn't sell just plain cream with one ingredient, cow's milk. All of the whipping cream, heavy cream, half and half, all of them had additional ingredients to thicken it or preserve it, even the organic ones. I was shocked. I just couldn't believe that they didn't have just plain cream. I realized, though, that the shelf life and that mouthfeel is really important to some consumers and some suppliers for their products, and the rules and regulations in the US and UK are different, as I've learned from some science podcasts I listen to.
Yeah, it's quite amazing, isn't it? But obviously, because you've been over here and the rules are different over here,
yeah.
I mean, as you know, Chris was brought up in Holland and they haven't got the laws on how much salt can be added to food, and he says when he goes back he finds it almost impalatable.
Yeah.
So what, you know, when you talk, do you think in the US they put all those preservatives in because it's potentially a warmer country in places? Is that why they try and extend the shelf life, or do you just what people are used to?
I think probably what they're used to. I mean, I don't know. I'm not an expert, but the food has to travel across the US. Quite a lot. The distribution centers are spread out. US, you said earlier, the US is really big.
It's massive.
But this isn't everywhere. There are some people who do shop multiple times a week or shop smaller at local farm markets. But typically, and in my experience, people will shop once a week or once every couple of weeks and just massively fill their refrigerators and pantries with longer lasting food.
So it's about shelf life. Chris will probably tell you this as well. We're very much more aware of what we buy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, somewhere like Marks and Spencer's, if you go into their chilled dessert cabinet, as I often do, there's only one thing out of the entire range that isn't full of absolute like loads of additives, and it's the one that's got a very, very short shelf life. It's got about 2 days, so I think that says it all, doesn't it? You know,
absolutely
interesting. So if you had any advice for any listeners then on food and diet, what would be your top tips?
Yeah, sure. I'm happy to share what works for me based on my experience. And I always like to learn from others, so I can't take credit for most of these. But to start, the first big thing for me is education, as I've mentioned before. Learn, keep relearning about what I'm eating, because that science keeps finding out more and more based on their testing and research. And as I mentioned, I am a big fan of podcasts. If I can mention a favorite one called Zoe Science and Nutrition.
Oh, is that the one? Sorry, is that the one where she's bringing out? I think she's bringing out a drink or something, is she? With Marks and Spencer, I just have heard that name, Zoe. You see,
I don't know. It's based at King's College in London and a US college as well. I don't know all the facts, but they're more of a science based research company. So I don't know if they're bringing out anything specific.
Yeah, brilliant. So that's a podcast, yes.
Yeah. Zoe Science Nutrition. I do try to go local where I can, supporting local suppliers. I try to know where my food comes from, if possible. And then, as mentioned before, add more beans, pulses, legumes, but not those tomato sugary ones. For example, if I want to add the cannelloni white beans to a stew or a dish, I find that we actually can add about 3 or 4 cans and the meal tastes and feels better for it.
And it's better for you as well. Yeah.
Yeah. And it just gives it more structure and that fiber. But I do look at the ingredients. You might be surprised what's added to make food taste more palatable and even keeps us buying it and eating more of it. Like there's artificial flavors, chemicals, preservatives, e-numbers. I don't even know what those are.
No, I know.
I try to avoid choosing those items where there's a long list of ingredients I can't pronounce or I've never heard of or can't find in my own pantry or fridge. And it helps me deciding on food swaps or small changes just to make better choices.
Yeah.
And I'd say my last one is balance and moderation. It can be easy to think and say everything in moderation, but with education, I find there are things I just don't eat now. However, there are times that my preferred choices aren't options or I do indulge in a vice. So on occasion, some things in moderation work for me to enjoy my life and my food.
Exactly. You know, last week we came into Chef at the radio station, somebody left a 6-pack of cherry Bakewells, and I just turned the packet over and looked at the ingredients and I was just horrified. I couldn't even pronounce half of them, but years ago I would have had it. Oh, free cake, I'll have that. But now it's like I'm not having that. Brilliant. So fantastic, and thanks, really big thank you for joining us today, because it is bank holiday weekend. And yeah. You've still come to speak to us. Fascinating story. And can you tell us, we always play out with a track, and you've chosen a fantastic track. Come on, tell us.
So, yeah, it might not be known to many people here. So I've chosen Cheeseburger in Paradise by the late, great Jimmy Buffett. I do like a good cheeseburger, which I know falls in that ultra processed camp, but there is a hack to improve it. Make the burger patty yourself with ground or minced beef over buying pre-prepared packaged ones. I know exactly what's in it, and you really don't need a lot.
No.
If you have good quality beef, so you can taste the burger itself rather than all the seasoning. My dad used to love Jimmy Buffett and his music, and it's very popular in Florida and Key West, so I highly recommend it if people want a place to visit. And then finally, my friend Erin and her son Skylar helped me choose this song, so a big shout out to them in Buffalo.
Brilliant. That's a fantastic name. Skylar?
Skylar, yeah.
Because it's spelled differently, like, wow. So thank you, Denise. I hope you've enjoyed your first time on radio.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Fantastic.
And, speak to you soon.
Yeah, great stuff. Here we are, Jimmy Buffett.
Tried to amend my carnivorous habits. Made it nearly 7 or 8. Losing weight without speed eating sunflower seeds. Drinking lots of carrot juice and soaking up.
very interesting track there. I've never heard a track by Jimmy Buffett before. Cheeseburger in Paradise. And we played that because we're talking to Denise Pullum. She's originally from America, but she was talking about her food journey moving from the USA to the UK. All good stuff. Thanks to Chris for organising that. Next week's guest speaker, all being well, will be Phil Muffett from the Mexbert and Swinton Astronomical Society. We're fast coming to the end of this week's edition of the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. On digital, if in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org, talking about science in all its different forms every Saturday morning, 11 till 12. Don't forget, the same team does Glory Days Rock Shows Monday, 1 till 3. And just because it's the bank holiday, that doesn't make any difference. We're still going to be here. Before we go, I'm just going to mention, because it's not on for very much longer, there's an exhibition at the Millennium Gallery in Sheffield. It's free entry, but you can donate. It's called Show Your Metal, so it's very relevant to Sheffield. It runs until the 29th of September, so it's only on for about another month. And metal, of course, frames our world, from technology and transport to jewellery, art and architecture. Its applications are countless and varied. Coinciding with the 400th anniversary of the Cutlers Company of Hallamshire, this major exhibition celebrates the marvel of the material in all its forms. So Sheffield's metalworking heritage dates right back to the 12th century, of course. Showcasing over 100 objects drawn from Sheffield's designated metalwork collection, Show Your Metal celebrates the pioneering advances that earned the city a global reputation. See examples of old Sheffield plate, electroplated metals and stainless steel, and discover the processes behind them. All good stuff. And we've got the film show, The Rare to go. Yay. I hope you're happier than last week, because you weren't happy last week, were you?
We were happy last week.
Oh, were you? Oh, you're off. It was a week before. You were most upset about the films you were reviewing. Bye-bye, folks.
Bye-bye.